On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. When American voters ended a dozen years of Republican dominance on Capitol Hill last November, the dramatic turnover came with charged expectations of the new Democratic majorities in both houses of Congress on war and presidential powers, on ethics and immigration and health care and much more. Democrats were out of the wilderness and back in charge by a whisker. Last weekend, the 110th Congress went home for its August recess. Republicans call it do-nothing. Hardcore Democrats wanted more, too. But Capitol Hill has changed. We'll take stock. Up next on Point, judging the 110th Congress. We will look at this hour at the culture and accomplishments, stumbles, and political strategies at work on Capitol Hill. We'll hear in a moment from Martin Cady, congressional correspondent from Politico.com. We've got a whole lot of other great panelists coming on with us as well. But let's hear, to begin with, from some of the participants. Here's Florida Republican David Putnam, chairman of the House Republican Conference, on the outside now looking in when it comes to majorities. Here he is on Saturday delivering that group's weekly radio address and slamming the Democrats on their performance so far.
This weekend, the Democrat Congress will head home with little to show for their first 7 months in the majority but a string of broken promises, misguided priorities, and record low approval ratings. In fact, it's now referred to as the Post Office Congress because all they do is pass bills that rename post offices. The irony is that despite their appreciation for the mail, it's clear Washington Democrats haven't gotten a single message from the American people.
Little to show, says the Republican, David Putnam. Democrats say they've had a successful first act back in the majority. Here's Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid of Nevada at a news conference last Friday.
Speaker Pelosi and I, at the election last November, indicated when the new Congress started, we would do certain things. We would raise the minimum wage, give the working men and women in this country a pay raise. We did that. We indicated that because of the culture of corruption that had infested Washington, that we're going to do something to change that. And change it we did.
And the first female speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, at a news conference on the same day, also touted the accomplishments of the Democratic Congress, looking all the way back to those first 100 hours.
At the beginning of this Congress, we had the first 100 hours, where in that short period of time, we had a flurry of activity that related to protecting the American people, growing our economy, strengthening our families, and preserving our planet, and doing that in a fiscally sound, highly ethical, and open and honest way.
Open, honest change, say the Democratic leaders. Let's dive in here on what's really going on. With us from New York, Martin Cady, congressional correspondent for Politico.com, the new Washington-based online journal of politics. Martin Cady, thanks very much for being here.
Hi, Tom.
Lots of nuance, lots of gray in this picture, but start out with just a simple what did they accomplish list for us, Martin. If you look at the Congress so far under Democratic leadership, what do you put in the win category?
Well, I'd say the Democratic Congress so far is batting about 500 on the agenda they laid out during the 2006 election. It's probably somewhere in between what Adam Putnam laid out and what the Democrats touted last week as they were heading home for the August recess. I mean, they did pass the minimum wage increase that was on their agenda. They have passed the 9/11 Commission recommendations. And they cleared the lobbying and ethics reform bill last week as well.
Right.
That was a big thing in last year's election. Big theme was corruption, and they passed that, and that was a reaction to the Jack Abramoff scandal. Both chambers have passed the S-CHIP bill, State Children's Health Insurance Program. They haven't reconciled those bills.
And the president promises, of course, to veto.
I'm sorry?
And the president promises, of course, to veto that one.
Well, he has promised to veto it. When they reconcile it in a conference, there may be changes that it's going to be tough for the president to veto a children's health insurance bill at the end of the day.
Right, right. And sorry, I interrupted. You had another coming there.
Well, they cleared a bill that was kind of under the radar dealing with education competitiveness. And so they've done a number of things that they said they would do, but they have not changed the course on Iraq the way a lot of the liberal base would like them to have done. And, immigration was stalled as well. And they're still working on an energy bill that is very divisive because it rolls back a number of tax breaks and subsidies on big oil.
So when you say batting 500, how is that for a Congress? I mean, look through history. If a Congress bats 500, should they pat themselves on the back or kick themselves in the fanny?
Well, so far, you know, we're only halfway through this session. We still have a couple of months in the fall, and it's not bad. The Republicans were doing pretty well playing defense during the first 5 or 6 months of this year, and then the Democrats hit a little bit of a roll in this last couple of weeks here. They really started knocking out items on their domestic agenda. But right at the end of this session, before they took this nice long August recess, the Republicans kind of won some momentum back when the president called on Congress to pass the new surveillance bill.
Right.
Democrats were kind of stuck there. They needed to figure out a way to pass the surveillance bill so that they didn't go home on the August recess looking like they didn't care about the war on terror. And President Bush got the bill that he wanted, and he signed it yesterday.
Does that mean that the Republicans, maybe via the White House, are still framing the national debate, even though the Democrats have the majorities in Congress? I mean, after all, it's framed there as a security issue rather than a issue of constitutional rights and civil liberties, which many see being offended by this new security surveillance bill.
Yeah, Democrats were not happy with this bill. It was an interesting vote to watch on Friday night in the Senate. This bill passed 60-28. There were 16 Democrats who crossed over. They clearly, some Democrats are worried about being portrayed as weak on national security. This is sort of the one Trump card that Republicans and that President Bush, despite his approval rating, still has. He can still march out there and say, there's still a threat of terrorism. We've heard the intelligence chatter. We need these tools to listen to communications from overseas. And the Democrats, clearly enough of them were concerned about that they passed it. And the Democratic leaders voted against this bill. But some of their rank and file did not follow.
Left the New York Times editorial page slack-jawed. They wrote, "The spectacle left us wondering what the Democrats, especially their feckless Senate leaders, plan to do with their majority in Congress if they're too scared of Republican campaign ads to use it to protect the Constitution and restrain an out-of-control president. What about executive power? Lots of investigations underway on Capitol Hill, but have we seen the tide turned on, you know, White House power and its rather extraordinary exercise under President Bush?"
Well, this Congress is far from done with its oversight. If there's one thing where they've certainly turn the table against the president, it's in the area of oversight. There's literally hundreds of investigations. We've seen subpoenas go to the Justice Department and the White House. There's a huge battle over Alberto Gonzalez's testimony. They're investigating the firing of the U.S. attorneys. They've investigated everything from the Pat Tillman death in Afghanistan to the oil companies. So if there's one mark that they have made through the oversight committees, that's challenging the administration. And they haven't made as much headway as they want, but it is different than how it was under Republicans in terms of challenging the administration.
We'll hear later in this hour from a Republican congresswoman who's critical of the Democrats. So let's bring in a couple of more guests as well right now, if I may. Julian Zelzer joins us. He is a leading congressional scholar, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University's Woodrow Wilson School, author of On Capitol Hill and the American Congress, joins us from Princeton, New Jersey. Julian Zelzer, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And our own news analyst, On Point's Jack Beatty, senior editor of the Atlantic Monthly, joins us from Hanover, New Hampshire. Jack, good to have you.
Hello, Tom, Julian, and Martin.
Julian Zelzer, you've got the long view as the historian here. Democrats back in power after a long time out in the cold. How do you assess what they've done with the gavels they've held on both sides of Capitol Hill for the last 7 months or so?
I think the Democrats have done pretty well. I think, you know, the outline we just heard of the legislation that was passed is pretty impressive in just a few months, given the structural constraints that Democrats face. And at the same time, I think even with the war in Iraq, I think they've made more progress than we often think. I do think Democrats have been able to apply a lot of pressure on the White House and to change public debate. I mean, if we think where we were in October 2006, just in terms of how we talk about Iraq, it's changed a lot. I mean, the discussion is now about an exit. The discussion is about how this ends. And I think the Democratic Congress has played an important role in this.
Jack Beatty, how do you see it? They lusted for a long time for what they got last November. What do you make of what the Democrats have done with their majorities?
Well, you know, the public doesn't make much of it at all. Terrible ratings, and you have to ask why. It seems to me that they raised expectations they did not, probably could not meet, and the public's judging them harshly against them. Let's start with the small stuff. Mm. You know, they promised reimportation of drugs from Canada, didn't deliver. They promised to have Medicare bargain for lower prices for prescription drugs, didn't deliver. Promised card check for union organizing, didn't deliver. Promised to do something about earmarks, and really they delivered their faux reform, and finally promised to end, to legislate an end to the war, and they didn't. Of course, the structural constraints, as Julian said, entered into that, and I strongly agree that, as General Petraeus put it, there is a Washington clock now on the Iraq war. That's what happened in November. There is a clock that's ticking to the end of that, and when the Republicans were in, if the Republicans had maintained control, I think that clock could have clicked on indefinitely.
Let's listen in on one really hot moment just last Thursday night. There was one ugly brawl on the floor of the House when Democrats brought the gavel down on voting on an agriculture bill. Republicans went wild, stormed out of the building, told reporters the Democrats had played dirty. Let's listen as New York Democrat Mike Gavel brings down the gavel.
The chair prematurely called the vote at 2:14. Called the vote at 2:14. While there were votes being entered, after all of the cards were added, the final vote was 212 to 216 nay.
Okay. Of course, that was Mike McNulty of New York, but it sounded more like the British Parliament there. What was going on, Martin Cady, and is that the sound of the 110th Congress roaring, shouting, screaming, stomping?
That's the sound of a lot of frustrated people at 11:15 p.m. on a Thursday, some 24 hours before they're about to go on a four-week vacation. So what you heard was frustration. They were tired, and Republicans felt like they cut the vote short. This type of thing happens every once in a while, and it happened a number of times under Republicans where they held the vote open, most notably the 2003 Medicare prescription drug bill. They held that vote open for a couple of hours at 5 o'clock in the morning in late November on a Saturday until they got the vote they wanted. This incident on Thursday night did not approach that. But what you saw was a lot of anger, sort of an Animal House atmosphere. Democrats were headed for a victory, and then a couple of Republicans started to change their votes. And remember, this was on a divisive issue. It was simply a motion, a procedural motion, but what the issue was that it would have explicitly said that illegal immigrants cannot receive the benefits in the agriculture spending bill. So a couple of South Florida Cuban-American Republicans started to change their votes to give their party a win. They had originally voted with the Democrats. They decided to vote with Republicans. In the middle of that, the Democrats, who hold the chair, and cutting off the vote is at the discretion of the chair, they cut it off, and everyone went bonkers.
So was it a food stamps issue then on illegal immigrants? Is that what you mean by...
It was the agriculture bill, so yeah. I'm not familiar with all the specific programs in there. And the Democrats said the benefits in this bill would not go to illegal immigrants anyway, but the Republicans wanted to make an explicit political point that no benefits could go to undocumented workers.
Julian Jelizer, what remains there is the angry echo of the Animal House going bonkers sound. Part of what the Democrats said coming back in was that they were going to rein in the sort of hyper-partisanship that had come to characterize Congress in the long reign of Republicans. Has that happened?
No, not at all. I think that was a false promise. The polarization on Capitol Hill runs very deep. It's been going on for decades, where the two parties are very divided. There's little room for bipartisan agreement, and members of each party really don't like each other much. The kind of story you just talked about, we've actually seen many incidents over the last three decades like this. When Democrats controlled Congress in the 80s, there was a similar incident where Speaker Wright, Jim Wright, held open a vote for long, and Republicans, basically screamed treason. And if you remember, a few years ago, Republicans had the Capitol Police round up Democrats so they'd have to vote on a certain piece of legislation. And this is one of the big obstacles Democrats face. Narrow majorities, polarization is high, and there's little trust between the members. And that's the environment they're trying to govern in.
So,
you know, Tom,
yes,
Tom, there's so little trust that on the floor the other day, Steny Hoyer with John Boehner, the Republican leader, they were going back and forth. And the issue was, do you trust our what it says on our computers, Hoyer says, about the some vote about it wasn't about the agricultural thing. It was a subsequent vote. Do you trust our count? Is it the same one on your computer? And the Republican was saying, no, it's not, and we're not going to deal with them. We don't trust your computer. We don't trust the number here. Somebody may be messing around with the numbers. I mean, it was that basic. I know what the vote was. The vote was, shall we adjourn?
Right. Shall we adjourn? As simple as that. Does anybody want comity here, Martin Cadia, or do both parties now find it in their interest to sort of stoke the base and look forward to November 08 with high passion?
I think we're already seeing the preview of 08. In September, we're going to have two pivotal things happen. It's going to be about war and money. They have to somehow figure out a way to clear all 12 appropriations bills, or they'll have to have what's called a continuing resolution, or roll them all together, or there's, you know, some of this chatter about whether President Bush will veto the bills and will be headed toward a budget showdown or even a government shutdown like in 1995. So that's not going to make things any prettier. And then, of course, there's the General Petraeus report due in mid-September, and each side is going to take whatever's in that, dissect it, and spin it for their own political gain. So I don't think we're headed for a better environment at all in the fall. And once we're into January and the primaries for 2008, political cooperation sort of probably won't happen at all.
So watch maybe for those public approval ratings to go even lower as Americans watch that with some disgust, to judge from how the polls have come in so far. Let's take a call from Gus in Watertown, Massachusetts. Gus, what do you see?
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
Being a liberal, I'd like to give my theory about why the approval ratings for Congress are so low.
Yeah, and let's hear it.
Being on the left, we've been waiting for the Democrats in Congress to stand up to this president, even on issues not having to do with the war, say maybe domestic wiretapping and issues like that. We've been waiting for it. And then the Democrats get into power, we're still waiting. So on the left, we're wondering, is this part of some master plan to turn the ship, to turn the conversation the way we want it? Or are they simply going to continue to roll over time and time again? So even though I'm obviously disapprove of President Bush,
yeah,
I disapprove of Congress as well.
Gus, what did you expect exactly? Did you think that those victories last November would bring a kind of revolution, a kind of sharp 180 course change in Washington? Did you believe in that? Did you think Democrats could embrace it and win if they did it?
Well, I understand that these things move slowly, that the conversation has to turn, but at some point, I'd like to see the Democrats play dirty, get down in the trenches, really stick up for something, really put the stake in the ground and say, this is as far as we're going to allow this president to take us, whether it's, you know, whatever the issue is. I just don't see them standing up.
Jack, for the Democratic left, there's the rub. They wanted big action, and they got something that looked more sort of middle of the road.
They did, but, you know, in terms of their standing up, I mean, in the S-CHIP bill, they ended they're going to fund the expansion partly by increasing cigarette taxes, but also by taking money, by ending the subsidies for insurance companies, which now manage Medicare. They compete with Medicare, and they get a subsidy for doing that, and they said, no, we're not going to do that. Paul Krugman rightly pointed to that as an example of, hey, the insurance lobby didn't work in Washington. And that's something, you know, to see a bill like that, that they stood up to the insurance companies at least. But you can't deny what Gus says. 41 House Democrats, 16 Senate Democrats voted for this surveillance bill that essentially, if an American is abroad and calls another American here at home, the government can listen to that. And it's all up to Attorney General Gonzalez. So that's a real and, you know, when you look at that vote, it's clear everyone pretty much of the 41 House Democrats were blue dog Democrats.
Yep.
That is, in marginal southern Midwestern districts, and they were protecting themselves against the soft on terrorism charge.
Julian Zelizer, what about, I think that Gus might look at the S-CHIP, the health care for children legislation, and say, you know, okay, but small potatoes, bigger fish to fry here, the war, executive authority. He wanted to see powerful action. He even says, play dirty, Democrats, there. You know, has this Congress, under its Democratic leadership, gone as far as a Congress can in confronting major issues like that, or has it held fire in your view?
No, I think it's gone very far, and you have to remember they have a limited number of votes. There is a filibuster in the Senate. I mean, if they had pushed for something more extreme on Iraq, they wouldn't have gotten it. They're having trouble just getting enough Republicans to vote for more moderate bills. And it's important to remember that Gus's frustrations are actually quite historic. As we said earlier, ratings of Congress as an institution are always poor. The exception is those moments when people actually like the institution. Americans like big bang politics. They like things to happen instantly. The reality is Congress is an incremental institution. It takes time to reach compromises. Even in the high points of Congress in the 30s and 60s, a lot of bills took years to get through. Something like Medicare was on the table and voted on for 5-6 years before it passes.
But somehow people are looking at the war in Iraq and the presidential, what some describe as kind of unconstitutional power grab, as maybe more urgent than how we handle, health care for seniors back in the 60s. I don't know. Let's get another voice in here, a Republican from Charlotte, North Carolina. Sue Myrick joins us, Republican Congresswoman representing North Carolina's 9th district, includes Charlotte and more, serving her 7th term. She was first elected to office during the Gingrich Revolution in 1994. Sue Myrick, thanks very much for being here. Hello, Congressman.
I am here.
Oh, terrific. Great to have you. Thanks for joining us. Give us your bottom line, your assessment of this Congress with Democrats back in the majority. The do-nothing label has been smacked on by Republican critics. What do you say?
Well, I just think it's a sad day for Americans because we're so partisan now that every issue becomes partisan. And, you know, it's time we're partisan Americans and stand up for what we believe. I understand there's always going to be differences on the left and on the right, but the majority of us get along and would like to see things happen. And
you came in with the Gingrich Revolution, didn't you? Sort of blaze the trail on hyperpartisanship with that era.
We did, and I will admit that is the cause of some of the problems today. That has bothered a lot of us, but you know. What we've tried to do since then is work together, and it isn't happening in the way that a lot of us, Democrat and Republican, would like to see. It's very frustrating because the committees really aren't operating in the way they used to, where, you know, both sides would come together and present a bill, and then it would go to the floor, and now there seems to be a bit of change between the time the committee does the bill and it gets to the floor because the leadership gets involved and changes that. And, you know, some of the things that have happened lately are just disturbing to Democrats as well as Republicans. You know, the vote the other night, you may have talked about it. I'm sorry, I'm not able to pick up your show here in Charlotte. But the fact that the vote was literally changed when we were voting on the agricultural bill, whether or not to give benefits to illegals, and, you know, it was 215 to 213 and said final on the board, and then it was actually erased from the tape, which has never been heard of before.
Congresswoman,
it disappeared.
Yeah, we understand that. Let me ask you, if somehow peace and harmony could prevail on Capitol Hill, we know we're a long way from that, but if folks on both sides of partisan lines reached out in a new way, what do you think might happen that hasn't happened so far in this 110th Congress or in the Republican Congresses that preceded? How would it change the reality of what gets legislated?
Well, I think it would change the reality in the sense that there are many items that we can agree on. For instance, with the CHIP program, the S-CHIP program that ended up without any Republican input, that was a situation where prior to that, in committee, we had agreed we could do a bill. I mean, we didn't have a problem, but that was not allowed to happen. And I think there are other issues, for instance, with, you know, terrorism and what's happening. And that's an overused phrase because it's really jihadism, and we don't talk about that. But that's an area where we can come together because most Americans don't have any idea of the depth, you know, of the infiltration of the jihadists and their supporters here in America and how it's been going on for a long time and what they want to do to destroy us. That's an issue that galvanizes us because, again, we're Americans, and that's what comes first.
Congresswoman, stand by for just a moment. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Let's take a caller here from Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Randy, you're on the air with Congresswoman Sue Myrick of Charlotte.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My point is that because the margins are so thin, if very little of significance is getting done. I really hold the Republicans responsible for it. I feel like, you know, given the incident that happened the other night on the floor when the, concerning the vote, and the Republicans are shouting shame, shame, shame. To me, they're acting like petulant children, and they're just out of sorts. And
but they are the minority now, Randy. I mean, they're not the majority anymore. So what do you expect?
What I expect is that it would be really good if the Democrats could try and appeal to some reasonable Republicans and maybe enhance their majority a little bit like that. But with 60 votes in the Senate required to get anything past Bush, I just think the Republicans are being obstinate. They're holding the line, and that's why nothing is happening.
Congresswoman Myrick, how about it? Yeah. Republicans, big obstacles.
Well, let me tell you this. On the fact, the reason there was an issue on this is because nobody can remember in the history of a vote being changed once it said final and also being erased from the tape. I mean, that's, to us, a very big violation, whether it happens with a Democrat or a Republican.
But we saw Both GOP been, strong arm wielding the gavel for a lot of years as well. This may be different in some measure, but
it's different because when you hold the vote open and don't call it final, every party's done that. For, I mean, everyone in control's done that for years. But this one was actually declared final. And actually, it's turned out that we have appointed a special investigative committee, which I understand hasn't been done since Iran-Contra, to look into it.
But take us beyond Thursday night. Randy's got a bigger problem here with Republicans. He says they're sort of laying across the road, keeping anything from happening, or not enough. What do you
say? Well, the biggest difference is in how we pay for things. And the Republicans were very bad for many years. It's one of the reasons we lost the majority, because we did not keep a lid on spending. There were a lot of us who tried, but we couldn't. We didn't have the votes. And the difference is in how we pay for things. Do we raise taxes to pay for it, which is what's happening now, or do we cut spending to pay for it?
Or just pay with debt, which is what the GOP did for most of the decade.
And that's why I'm saying it was wrong. I'm not standing up for what the GOP did. I didn't agree with that when it was happening. That's part of the problem. What we've got to do, though, is there are enough of us who want to work across party lines to make things happen, and I just hope that we can continue to do that.
David's calling from Providence, Rhode Island. David, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I consider myself a fiscal conservative and a social liberal, and I find this Congress to be appalling in its lack of conviction on any front. One such case would be, I called each and every one of my congressmen and senators throughout the country and asked them for a Bush war tax. They called for the war, and they don't find a way to pay for it. That's one such issue.
Yeah.
Another thing is, well, go ahead.
No, give us your list.
Well, the other thing is this Congress approved of the elimination of habeas corpus in the last Congress. I find that any constitutional look at the issue would find that appalling, and the Republicans and the Democrats should be ashamed of allowing the executive branch to run roughshod over the Constitution. So I find both issues to be something that I wish the Democrats would stand up and at least make a statement about.
So high stakes, but maybe not high enough ambition. Martin, Katie, this goes to the heart of a big stream of concern here. We've got callers saying, look, you know, we've got a crisis. We want these Democrats to swing for the fences in addressing it, and they're not. How do you think the Democratic leadership would respond? How do they respond to that vein of criticism?
What the Democrats would say is two things. Regarding habeas corpus, there were amendments in defense bills this year to try to restore habeas corpus rights for the Guantanamo detainees. Mm. That came under a veto threat. The Democratic Congress also did pass a troop withdrawal amendment to the defense spending bill for Iraq, the supplemental spending bill earlier this year. It was vetoed, and they don't have a veto-proof majority. They have attempted to do the things they tried to do, but they said they would do. But they don't have enough to override a veto, and the Democrats believe they've made their point. If they've passed these bills, they've been vetoed. The same thing goes for the embryonic stem cell research. The Congress cleared a stem cell bill earlier this year, and it was vetoed. They're just a couple votes short in the Senate of an override, and they're on that. So they would argue that they're at least reframing the political debate, even if they're not getting a major league legislative wins.
Jack Beatty, do you see a Democratic leadership sort of riding the clutch instead of hitting the accelerator because, this sounds cynical, but because it keeps those issues alive and hot powder for the November 08 elections?
Well, there may be something to that, and yet I've been surprised at how they have acted on the war. At an airport, Washington airport, I saw a Democratic congressman and asked him about that, and I said, look, here they have very conservative members. I'm thinking of the three new members from Indiana, and they are very liberal members, Barbara Lee and so on from the West Coast, and yet they both voted for this, whatever the bill was. It was a time limit bill. How did that happen? And this fellow said, well, you know, Nancy Pelosi, she's not given much credit maybe by the public at large, but within the institution, she knows how to put together coalitions. And she just went to each group and she said, look, the train is going to leave the station. You ran against the war, she said to the conservatives. Here's your chance. You've got to be with us. To the liberals, don't make the perfect the enemy of the possible. We're going to go. And she really did it. And he was just, you know, candidly admiring her internal leadership skills in getting that war ahead. And look at Harry Reid. A year ago, he was weak on this war. He was somewhere in the middle. He didn't quite know. And he had a real conversion experience. He said it was the last time he went to Walter Reed that did it for him. But he has become very strong on it. So that they really did surprise me on the war.
Julian Zelizer, Medicare, Medicaid, huge legislation, of course, but you can hear people seeing things we're facing now with the war, with the extension of executive power, presidential powers, different in kind, I think, and more of a, to those who see them this way, of a crisis in their nature. Could the Congress have, the Democratic-led Congress, have thrown down harder on these issues, or is there simply a limit to how, you know, how big a stick Congress can wield for some reason?
There's a limit. I mean, whether we're talking about Medicare or whether we're talking about war, Congress is not a singular person. In this Congress, we have liberal Democrats, moderate Democrats, and Republicans who generally against the war. I mean, it's in favor of the war and against any kind of change at this point. And we have a White House that's very aggressive, either with an outright veto or more subtle ways of exerting executive power. So when someone says they should be tougher, we need to think of what exactly that means and what the options are for a and a Pelosi. I think in Iraq they have actually done a lot, and they're running into some limits about how much change can happen at this point. All wars take a long time to get out of. That's the tragedy of war. And even with Vietnam, it took Congress, even once it was really in oppositional mode, many years to apply the kind of pressure that was needed to draw down that conflict. I think with the security issue, there's more of a sense that Democrats don't know what they want, meaning executive power, meaning wiretapping. I don't think the party is as clear as it actually has become on Iraq about where they need to go in the next few years. And part of that was the disarray that we saw as Republicans were able to get that bill through the other night.
Martin, what kind of grades are Harry Reid and Nancy Pelosi getting on Capitol Hill from their own parties and close watchers like yourself as congressional leaders here? What sort of performance assessment?
Well, it's tough to give out grades 7 months into a two-year congressional session. So at this point, I think the grade is incomplete. They give themselves, of course, high marks for turning the tables on the president on the war, even though they haven't done anything legislatively to change it. Like I said earlier, they're probably batting about 500 on their 6-for-06 agenda. But you can hear from your callers, especially those who identify themselves as liberal. And they say, okay, thanks for those you know, smaller bills, those domestic accomplishments, but the reason you're there is to end the war. And that sort of points to one of the divides within the Democratic caucus, the liberal anti-war group, the Out of Iraq caucus, which is growing. It's probably well past 80 members. There's agitation on that side. They don't want to compromise with Republicans, even though the only way you'll be able to defund the war or actually enforce a troop withdrawal timetable is if you get at least one-third of Republicans in both chambers to join the Democrats.
Let's take a call from Nashville, Tennessee. Paul, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to speak about the larger context this week when the surveillance bill was passed. This was passed like the same week that Hillary and Obama are calling for, are speaking about the invasion of Pakistan.
Obama, certainly, yep. potentially. Yeah.
Didn't Hillary come out and say she also would favor that?
I'm not sure where that dust up stands at this point, but what do you take from that, Paul?
I think it's kind of bizarre, you know. these might not be the Democrats we thought we were electing.
Jack, there's presidential politics and security policy all mixed up, and you know, people looking for their footing in that fog at this point, I guess. Paul's looking for maybe something we can't have, which is one line from a party that's in the midst of a run up to a presidential election, primaries, and all the rest.
That's right, and they have to worry about that majority. I mean, on the farm bill, they caved. They allowed subsidies to go to people earning up to $1 million. And that was, even the reformers wanted to cut that almost by more than half. But they did that to preserve Midwest members. And then on the security issue, I mean, those 41 House, those blue dogs, they're in competitive districts. They're worried. But, you know, the odd part about it is, Karl Rove made last year's election a referendum on domestic security. I mean, he really said the Democrats are against this wiretapping because they're for the terrorists. He said it on National Public Radio in an interview with Robert Siegel. Mm. And we're running against that to tell the people that they're weak on security. And they lost the election. And John Tester in very, you know, red Montana not only ran against domestic wiretapping, he said, I want to repeal the Patriot Act, and he won. So you wonder, is there more room there for some courage for these blue dogs, given what November said and given the results of things like Tester's election in Montana?
There's a big question that hovers. Let's go to Mary Ann calling from Newport, Rhode Island. Hi, Mary Ann. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just have a general question. Is it really fair to say the Democrats have a majority in Congress when they only really have a majority in the House, and Bush is wielding his veto power, and they don't really have enough of a majority in the Senate to overturn?
So 231 to 202 in the House, and, of course, in the Senate, I mean, you know, Harry Reid looks out there at Joe Lieberman, who votes with Republicans on war issues, and with Tim Johnson of South Dakota, who's still recovering from brain surgery, and says it's 50-49, Harry Reid has said, and we're the 49. A good point. Julian, what about it? Are these margins of majority so thin that the Democrats cannot be expected to try to do more?
They are thin. I mean, we've talked about how historically this is not a great setup for big legislation. Democrats are facing a lot of obstacles in terms of just passing bills, the very practical thing that Congress does. And so I think we always have to come back to those numbers. I think they're extremely important. I would go back to the previous caller and do say that I think Democrats at some point need some kind of broader argument, whether conservative or liberal or moderate, about what national security means to them. I think they've done a better job outlining their opposition to Iraq than they have offering as an alternative to what Republicans say in terms of, you know, how to protect the homeland, what they would do. And I think part of this ambiguity we keep hearing and part of their vulnerability on national security comes from the fact they have not moved from being an oppositional party into a governing party on this problem of national security. And it will be interesting to see kind of how they take that or if they remain in the wilderness a bit.
So room for leadership there. Let's take a call from California, Malibu, California. Michael, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi. What do you know?
I'd like to address the issue of the bickering between the conservatives and the liberals that's been going on for years.
Sure.
I used to live in Canada, and I remember the same thing going on in Canada between the conservatives and liberals. And that all came to a stop very abruptly when a third party entered the system. I think America is overdue for that. And it would definitely put a little twist into this bickering that's been going on forever.
If the Democrats can't make a change with majorities, how does a third party do it with what presumably at the beginning would be a real minority status?
Well, a third party would give a little bit more than the very slim majority that Democrats have right now in either house. In other words, if two parties joined together, they would have probably enough votes to even withstand a veto by Mr. Bush.
And or maybe be the swing that got courted by the others. I mean, This comes, in a way, to the heart of it. Martin Cady, we saw this morning in the Washington Post, you had Harold Ford Jr., of course, the former representative from Tennessee, congressman, now chairman of the Democratic Leadership Council, and Martin O'Malley, governor of Maryland. They wrote, "The progressive center has a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, that is now, to win back the White House, expand its margins in Congress, and build a political and governing majority that could last a generation." But they're saying Democrats don't swing hard for left field here. Stick with the center, and maybe you can have it all again. Is that just the DLC talking, Martin, or a wider view?
Well, it's interesting. At this point, it might just be the DLC talking. Both the DLC and the Daily Kos had their had gatherings, conventions recently. Right. And every Democratic presidential candidate, you know, marched to Chicago and talked to the liberal Netroot agitators for the yearly Kos convention. But there wasn't a great turnout at the DLC, which was, you know, the root of the Bill Clinton sort of third way in the 90s.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
I mean, right now, I don't know if the Democratic presidential candidates are taking that advice that they need to tack to the center in order to win the left and the center and have a true governing majority.
Julian, what does history tell us about what's likely to be more effective for the Democrats? You know, they squeaked back into the majority, but they'd like to get a lot more, as you can hear there from Ford and O'Malley. So better to swing hard or to swing center?
If you have to guess, they're going to continue to swing center just because they don't have many options. And they're going to continue to frustrate, ironically, the people who will be most active in the election, those on the left. The reason that Daily Kos has a bigger turnout than DLC is not just some ideological shift in the public. It's the fact the primary system since the 70s has been loaded toward primaries where activists come out more than, you know, moderate voters. And that's how our political system works. So that's why candidates play to that part of the electorate, and that's why members of Congress do as well. So there's a real tension, I actually think, between how you win an election and how you obtain legislation in the structures we've talked about.
So, Jack, how do you read the Democrats then? Here we are 7 months more or less in, off on August recess. Martin says they're batting 500. Good enough? And you know, as Republicans continue to look for their way back in, do you see Democrats delivering enough with the right strategy and posture here to push their majority forward?
I think it's going to be tough to push it forward, although when you look at seats, there are more Republican vulnerable seats than Democratic seats. But this approval rating for Congress, yes, of course, they approve of their own Congress member. But if it gets any lower, I think that the things could really be, they could really get into trouble. So I think they have to worry about that. But you know what, Tom? The Mae West hold is gone, and we all should be grateful for that. That's a hold that a senator can put silently on a bill or an appointment, and he doesn't even have to reveal his name. And the Mae West hold is, I'm holding this, but come up and see me sometime, and we'll negotiate.
Send me a lobbyist.
So that's good. Yeah, send me a lobbyist.
So there's a victory for ethics, Julian. That got a pretty good reception last week, and Americans had been awfully concerned, you know, about where ethics were going in Congress. Do you see it as enough in this new legislation to turn the tide there?
Yeah, I don't think it's going to transform ethics on Capitol Hill. Look, it was an important measure. I think it was some kind of reaction to the 2006 election with some substantive changes. That said, it doesn't deal with two of the biggest problems with ethics on Capitol Hill: the flow of private money into elections, which is still there and the pressures will exist, and finally, the lack of effective enforcement for any ethics rules, including the one we had before. So I think, you know, there is something to praise there, but at the same time, there's two big issues still looming that will lead to more Jack Abramoffs in the future.
Well, everybody off for August right now. They'll be back in September with the big Iraq report looming and big budget battles looming, and we'll be in the thick of it all over again. We're grateful to each of you for helping us look at it this hour. Martin Cady with Politico.com. Martin, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Julian Zelizer at Princeton's Woodrow Wilson School, author of On Capitol Hill. Julian Zelizer, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And Jack, good to have you as always.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.